Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And, Jim, we've been doing this podcast now for over 2 years, and there's a quote from Nancy Pelosi that came a few months before we started this podcast that is perhaps the most blood-curdling comment we've had during the first Obama administration, and I think most people know what it probably is. Take a listen.
But we have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it.
And, of course, most of what we've seen, if not just about everything we've seen come out of this bill, makes us cringe and makes us really furious that the Democrats passed that bill and did so without reading it. But finally, after nearly 3 years, Jim, there might be one tiny silver lining about the fact that they didn't read this thing, and it relates to the gun debate that is now unfolding in Washington. Here's how CNN's Jim Acosta explains how what very few people knew what was in the bill might actually end up helping those of us who actually like the Second Amendment.
Few in Washington knew that buried in the legislation's more than 900 pages was a gift to the nation's powerful gun lobby. But here it is. A provision entitled Protection of Second Amendment Rights. It states the government and health insurers cannot collect any information relating to the lawful ownership or possession of a firearm or ammunition. So who put it in there? It might surprise you to learn it was this man, the most powerful Democrat in Congress, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid.
And the story goes on, Jim, to point out that Reid basically put it in there to keep the NRA out of the health care debate, and to some extent that was successful. So the fact that there's actual statutes on the books restricting the government from doing some of the things that's being talked about here, it's actually good.
Yeah, a couple interesting thoughts here. The first is that you know that the Obama administration and pro-gun control folks would love nothing more than to blame cruel, reckless, heartless, right-wing Republicans for this. And in fact, it's Harry Reid who does this. Two, you got to admit, this is kind of smart politics on the part of Harry Reid back in 2009, 2010, recognizing that Obamacare was going to have a steep enough climb as is. And I think we can very safely argue that it cost Democrats the House and had many political consequences. That he needed to get the NRA to stay out of this, and this was a good way to do it. And, you know, the NRA could say, look, we're a single-issue organization. Whatever other problems we have with Obamacare, it doesn't affect gun ownership, so we're not going to get into it. The wonderful news for us here is that, look, this now complicates any effort to have doctors collect data on this information. And I think the fear was that at some point health insurance companies were going to punish people for having a gun in the house, make you pay higher rates or something like that. Maybe have higher rates for people in regions that are high gun ownership rates, and all kinds of ways of basically demonizing gun owners and making them make their life harder. We are seeing that in the Gawker publication of all gun permit holders in New York, and the newspaper up in New York State. You know, the attitude is, look, if we can't just do away with the Second Amendment the way they'd like to do, let's just make life hard as possible for gun owners and make it as, you know, stigmatized and demonized and attacked as possible. And lo and behold, here is Obamacare saying, you can't enlist doctors to do that. And so it'll be fun to watch the recriminations over this. It's worth knowing that all they have to do is pass a law to do this. Having said that, I don't know if you – I think it's now pretty unlikely you would see that pass the House. So, you know, the joys of gridlock are that I don't think that there's any way for Democrats to easily get this law off the books. I suppose Republicans might be saying, well, we could take that out in exchange for repealing all of Obamacare and make Democrats ask themselves just how much they want this part of Obamacare repealed.
That leads us into martini number two now. And yesterday, on Wednesday, Vice President Joe Biden holding the first of his basically photo op conversations with folks on different sides of the gun issue. Yesterday was his allies on the gun control side. Today, he's probably going to browbeat behind closed doors the NRA and other folks to get on board somehow. But here's the comment that got a lot of people very upset yesterday in terms of how the administration plans to pursue the changes they want to see in the law.
The president is going to act. There are executive orders, executive action that can be taken. We haven't decided what that is yet, but we're compiling it all with the help of the attorney general and all the rest of the cabinet members, as well as legislative action we believe is required.
Now, Jim, some people are suggesting that the government, under the Handgun Control Act of 1968, could basically classify anything they want as semi-automatic or automatic, even if the gun isn't actually in that normal classification. But when this comment from Joe Biden came yesterday, you saw not only the conservative blogosphere and the Twitter sphere and everything else, it just exploded.
Some would argue this is paranoid on the part of gun owners, but I don't think it's quite so unlikely because, look, I think it was Ala Pundit at Hot Air. I put it out pretty, you know, made it pretty clear. Look, we've seen one gun control law passed after another, and there really is no, because there is no perfect gun law that could prevent all crime or all mass shootings, sooner or later, someone will commit a horrific crime with a gun. And they'll be able to have an argument for one more law. And so it's a slippery slope argument, the idea that at some point they're never going to want just one bite at the apple. The gun control movement wants the absolute, you know, ultimately, for there to be no private ownership of firearms of any kind in this country. And besides the logistical difficulties of implementing that, that basically is a de facto elimination of the Second Amendment. And those of us who believe that the Constitution means something aren't willing to just let those things be waved away. They certainly can't be waved away by an act of Congress, and they sure as hell can't be waved away by an executive order. Now, there's going to be certain limitations as to what the president can do on this, and I think there's a very worthwhile cautionary note to make on this concern on the part of gun owners, which is that Barack Obama very rarely is willing to take extraordinary political risks, and to do a far-reaching executive order limiting the Second Amendment would be the definition of a giant political risk heading into the 2014 midterm. So I actually think that there's more bluster here than actual action that we'll see from the administration. But I think it says something about Biden that he put that on the table, putting, you know, gasoline on the fire of anger and concern and suspicion on the part of America's gun owners.
Yeah, who knows if that was even what he was supposed to say, knowing Joe Biden.
It is Biden. I mean, you know, it could have been, you know, he could have been just seen a squirrel and just kind of been started rambling or something. But let's, you know, for the sake of our constitutional rights, we can't just assume this is him just Biden being Biden.
No, absolutely not. I think he's probably throwing it out there to try and intimidate some folks who maybe aren't so passionate on the Second Amendment, but generally side with the Second Amendment to try and drag them over the line and get something passed. Although that might work in the Senate to get enough votes to avoid a filibuster. I don't think they have much hope of doing anything significant in the House, which is a good martini in my mind. But Jim, it was not that long ago, as we hit our third martini here, it was just last month, in fact, where we were talking about Rob Parker over at ESPN, who was referring to Redskins quarterback Robert Griffin III as potentially a cornball brother. But now that he's blown out his knee in the Redskins playoff loss on Sunday, RG3 has become a player in an even more bizarre theory here from columnist Cortland Malloy, a liberal over at the Washington Post. And here's the first few paragraphs of his column on January 8th. So, Washington football fans, how's that offensive team name and demeaning sports mascot working out? Whooping and hollering as RG3 goes on a Redskins warpath, only to leave a trail of tears when his wounded knee gets buried at FedEx Field. In this obscene home team sports fantasy, the gifted Robert Griffin III was reduced to a noble savage. Let the Redskin play hurt. He can take it. Hail to the young, brave-hearted quarterback as he limps into battle on that injured knee. Three cheers as he fights on one good leg for old DC. And when he's felled during Sunday's playoff game against the Seahawks, bringing the postseason to an ugly and immensely unsatisfying end, torn ligaments no doubt shortening his own career as well, Washington gasps in horror. Bad karma, I tell you, that team name. And Malloy goes on to point out that ever since 1992, the last time the Redskins won the Super Bowl, that was also the year a D.C. resident became the lead plaintiff in a suit demanding a change to the Redskins' nickname. And so, therefore, because of this progressive push for more sensitivity in sports mascots, Jim, that's why the Redskins have been pretty much terrible for the last two decades and why RG3 had to undergo reconstructive knee surgery.
First thought, boy, I thought I was bad with puns. And then you see all of his wounded knee and all that, those sorts of comments. So it's karma. It just took a while. And here's the thing. It's an interesting system of karma that Cortland Malloy sees there, because it's not like RG3 named the team. You know, it's like the team is cursed. If you step onto it, your knee will be twisted and terrible things will happen to you. Now, a couple of thoughts here. The first is that I will now come out of the closet, so to speak, Greg, and let you know that I have voted for Democrats in the past. And one of the Democrats that I voted for sometime back in the 90s was Anthony Williams, the Democrat who was running for mayor of D.C. back when I lived in the district. The reason I voted for him was that he was a pretty darn good Democrat as far as they go in the District of Columbia. And the Republican candidate, who was a city councilwoman named Carol Schwartz, talked about renaming the Redskins as one of her priorities. And I just looked around at the crime, the failing schools, the economic disaster that was Washington, D.C., and thought that any Republican who really is worried about a team nickname, I just can't vote for in good conscience. And so I happily voted for Tony Williams that year. I can't imagine that anybody in government is losing any sleep over renaming a football team. Having said that, I think we can all agree that if you are naming Redskins, does sound rather awkward to the modern ear. I think if you were naming a team today, even if you wanted to call them the Fighting Native Americans or something like that, you might have done that. You wouldn't have picked the team Redskins. But there's a way around this, Greg, and I've actually kind of shopped around this idea. Nobody seems to be that enthusiastic, but I'll bounce it off of you.
Okay.
So remember the old logo the team used to have instead of the head of the Native American chief?
It's just the feather.
They had the just a big maroon R.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You've seen in the old NFL films footage or something.
Right.
So if you go with that, first of all, it takes away the issue of the logo and the second thing. And the second thing is I want a giant mascot, Greg, that's a great big potato. Sure, it's a redskin. You keep calling the team the Redskins and all that stuff. It's just not a person redskin. So that struck me as a good compromise. You keep the team name. It just refers to a completely different kind of redskin that day. And, you could say they the defensive mash or something like that. Or, if they have the fun bunch little receivers, you could call them the potato chips or something like that. Now, some people might say this is better suited for a team based out in Idaho or something, but anyway, it was a way to deal with that. The other thing alternatively is to, rename the team the Chieftains or something like that, to come up with some sort of Native American themed name. You can keep the colors, keep the logo, all that stuff. Just don't call it Redskin. Someday the owner, Dan Snyder or some folks involved in the Redskins might want to make that sort of decision. But in the meantime, you've got a couple decades worth of NFL tradition out there, a whole bunch of fans who certainly have no problem with it. The idea that, football players' injuries are a result of karma. What aviation disaster have the Jets been paying for all these years, okay? Or what kind of endangered species have your Bears been suffering for? So I think it's rather inane to try to find a some sort of grand cosmic moral significance to football players' injuries and suggest that it comes down to, a perceived racial insensitivity or something like that. Even by the standards of Courtland Malloy, that's a particularly silly column.
That is a stretch. That is a stretch, yes, even by the Washington Post standards. But it's our duty to report such things, so we do so.
Listeners will understand why we decided this is a natural crazy martini material.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.